up to the bat when we stopped last time. And I'm going to ask Roger Martin. Is Roger in the room?
He's right up here.
He was saying he wanted to talk. You have to be careful. You might get what you ask for, Roger. I invite you to come first.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent Goodwill Industries. Last week when we adjourned, three of us were up here, and you just heard from the executive director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association.
Excuse me, I'm going to reconvene us as a full committee now that we have a quorum. Thank you. Go ahead, Roger.
Mr. Chair, looking at the committee room, Chair, I'd be happy if you went into the work session right now. We can just cut all short.
You want to do that?
I want to say something about both these bills, and I think most of you know I don't mince words. I was a member of the legislature in the late 1960s and early 70s when this state embarked on a program to stop warehousing people. And I want to go back to the history because I think it's very important you understand the context we're looking at this legislation in. When I was a freshman legislator in 1967, one of the requirements was all legislators, freshman legislators, must visit the state institutions. An unbelievable, chilling, frightening experience. And I will never forget going through the Oregon State Mental Hospital. It had just been recently renamed that from the Insane Asylum. And it was full of not just hundreds, but thousands of people who were warehoused because we didn't know anything better to do with them. They were people with treatable today, in today, very treatable diseases, manic depression, other mental illnesses. But we warehoused them because we didn't know what else to do. And it was an ugly sight. People wandered aimlessly around all day long, some with their clothes off because there weren't enough people to make sure they stayed clothed and were naked. They followed people that tried to touch you as you walked through because you were an unusual sight. Most of us were scared more than we were anything else. It left an impression on me that the state had to stop doing that, and we did stop. And we have mainstreamed people. Thankfully, medication became available. And those people who we weren't able to treat before were treatable. As soon as we started sending people back into the community, mainstreaming them, it became very obvious you cannot medicate someone and then give them nothing to do. It's vital that these people have something to do. And from that came the myriad of workshops, sheltered workshops, and other programs for rehabilitation of people with disabilities. Now, I'm talking about the extreme disabilities here, but I also want to talk about the other disabilities. I have a cousin who is blind. She's 55 years old. She spent her early childhood at the school for the blind here. She's not only blind, she's also has some other disabilities. When she was finally sent home, when the school for the blind closed, she went into a shelter workshop in Hillsborough, where she's been since 1972. It's the great crowning achievement of her life to be able to each day go to work and do something that you and I would find very boring. But it's a real accomplishment for her. She earns an income, and it's a very rewarding experience for her. Goodwill Industries, who I represent, provide a myriad of programs. One of them I want to talk about briefly is one that's right across in Polk County at Dallas, where over two dozen of the former patients at our most profound of all institutions, Fairview, are employed. One of the individuals, and I won't bore you, and I didn't bring the film with me, but I've got an 8-minute tape I'd have to be happy to share with you. One of the most profound people there had been interned at, or had been an inmate, I would call it, at Fairview for 41 years. Judged by the staff to be incorrigible, judged by the staff to be probably potentially dangerous. He's now a foreman at a facility over in Dallas where they do recycling of paper. What he does all day long would drive us probably kind of bonkers after 10 minutes. He holds paper and shreds it through a shredder all day long. He's gone from being incorrigible and difficult to being someone very proud of what he's been able to accomplish. Now, all of these kind of things exist because of several programs. One of them your Senate as a whole has already dealt with, and that's the workers' comp insurance subsidy that you dealt with in Senate Bill 288, and it's now over in the House. The other issue that we're very concerned about are these two things about the set-aside and the contracts that we have with the state of Oregon to do various things. I would encourage you, by the way, because you've had all kinds of allegations of wrongdoing, to talk to Cam Burney, who's here today for the Department of Administrative Services, and he will tell you that the allegations are incorrect, and I will tell you they're incorrect. If you're trying to redefine, and this is what these bills do, redefine what the handicap and what disabled means, you're fighting a whole body of law from the federal government and from state government. But I'm not interested in doing that at all because I think the things that Goodwill Industry does and that St. Vincent de Paul does and the other people here are the very kind of things that you in government want them to be doing. This is the true private partnership where government is contracting out, at no cost to you for the most part, contracting out services that you're incapable or we don't want to do or we find too expensive to do. Goodwill Industries is a very large operation of about $36 million this year. Not one penny of that comes from the general fund of the state of Oregon. We raise our money by selling used goods, and all of you who live in them, and both of you who live in the urban areas, have seen the collection points. Goodwill Industries of the Columbia Willamette, which is the one in Portland and encompasses everything south to Lane County, is the largest Goodwill of its kind in the world. The largest in the world, larger than Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, all the major cities back east. And they've accomplished that by a very efficient collection system of selling used goods. My wife is the largest contributor in the world, I tell her all. Because she regularly gives my closet and most of the things that I own away. But that is the way that money is raised, and it's turned around and it's put into programs for training people who have a very difficult time finding jobs. And I invite any of you to come over and visit or visit any of the other facilities. And when you see the kind of work they do, you won't be considering ways to impede what they're doing, and that's what these bills do. These are not intended to correct anything. I mean, let's not be facetious. The private businesses that are encouraging you to pass these bills are not trying to streamline government. They're trying to cut down on the competition. And I can understand that. If I were in private business and I had a business similar to the kind that some of these facilities have, I would be concerned, and I guess I would be trying to find ways to do it. Your decision is what's in the best public interest, and I would tell you overwhelmingly the best public interest is that we continue to encourage the private nonprofit agencies that are represented in this room who are doing the work the state can never do of employing people that have a difficult time finding a job. You know, Goodwill Industries has been approached by the Oregon State Department of Employment because, interestingly, Goodwill, and I'm sure the same is true with St. Vincent de Paul and others, do a better job of finding and putting people to work than the state can. And the State Department of Employment is exploring ways to use the techniques and the training that these folks have developed to try to put the unemployed to work in the state. Now, our unemployment rolls aren't very high at the present time, so it's not a crush that it may be in the future. But I would love to have any of you come over and visit at Goodwill Industries and see how we train people in office skills, how to use computers, And I've walked in there, and I've looked around the room, and it's obvious there are some people you can obviously tell where they're disabled. If a person's in a wheelchair, it's not very hard to figure out they're disabled. But tell me how you figure out if somebody has severe diabetes and is under medication. Is that, tell me how you see that and recognize that. Or if somebody is being treated for manic depression and it's being treated and is being trained, how can you tell by looking at them? And I guess that's what the judgment seems to be. They don't look disabled, therefore they shouldn't be disabled and they shouldn't be in these programs. I also, and I want to challenge the people that are here proposing this, I want them to try to show you all of these, quote, allegations that the Department of Administrative Services is lax in the administration of the inspection of the program to make sure that we do have enough disabled. And I don't have any fear in saying that because Goodwill Industries averages about 90% of anybody in a particular contract or program is disabled. And obviously, if you're working in a program that requires computer expertise, somebody has to have the training. And we have trainers and people in some of our programs that are not disabled. They're computer experts, and they're the ones passing on that knowledge to someone else. But I think this whole thing is much ado about nothing. I think it was aggravated by the people of the state of Oregon who set the policy on prison industries when they passed the ballot measure that requires everybody in prison to work. That caused another rift in the private sector by people who were in the free enterprise system and all of a sudden find prison industries competing against them. This program has been around. I talked to Dave Frohnmayer personally. Dave Frohnmayer, President of the University of Oregon, was a member of the 1977 legislature when we passed, and I would remind everybody, unanimously in both houses of the legislature, and I was the minority leader in the House at the time, we passed the bill that set up the state set-aside. It's a damn good program. It ought to stay that way and don't encumber it by these two bills that I don't think are merit your passing. Mr. Chairman, thank you for letting me express my opinion.
And thank you for letting us know where all your new suits come from.
Where they all go to. I was wearing one last week that I thought should go.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Maybe we could have his wife talk to his wife and we could work this out.
That's the first Barb comment I think I've ever heard you make. What does this here? We go from here. We got any?
No, it should not be.
Tim Crowell and Bob Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Crowell, and I'm director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. I'd like to thank you for extending testimony. I know you ran out of time last time. We really appreciate this opportunity to
fully, out of everything last time.
Fully express our concern. You don't see as many people with disabilities in the audience today who were here last week. It's very difficult. Some of the staff had to get up at 4 a.m. to bring people last time. And you know, we're short-staffed everywhere, but I assure you this is of no less importance this week than it was last week. It's not possible for us to do that every time, and 8 a.m. is a very difficult time in group homes. Unlike the testimony you typically receive, we're not here to ask you for money. We're not here to ask you for new services. We're simply here to ask you to protect and defend a law that's been on the books for 22 years and that works very well. It has tremendous human and economic impact. You're going to hear a lot from people in this room about the benefits. So I want to focus on just a few other questions. Our association, as you know, represents nonprofit providers across the state. I did a quick count as I was sitting here looking at your districts. 32 of our over 70 members are in the districts represented by your committee. Why does Oregon and most other states have laws like this and the federal government? Because employing people with disabilities for the vast majority of your direct labor is a very expensive process. We need ongoing contracts that we can count on. to be able to provide the training necessary for people with disabilities, to provide the extra square footage, the extra equipment to employ 2, 3, or sometimes 4 times as many people as necessary to replace one person without disabilities. We cannot compete on a low bid. Virtually no public contracts went to qualified rehab facilities in Oregon or across the country until laws like this were enacted, because we, by definition, use a labor force that's less than 100% efficient. As Roger pointed out, as we continue to move away from state institutions, and I know members of this committee and Chair Fisher presided over the very difficult Fairview hearings last session, we need to provide opportunities for them. We would encourage you not to restrict opportunities at the very time we need them the most. What I've given you is our testimony, a timeline of events that relate to various kinds of opportunities that the Fair Competition Alliance has had to bring up issues and how they've been dealt with. I'd like to make a few points to correct what I saw as inaccuracies in last week's testimony. The law does not mandate that all public contracts go to qualified rehabilitation facilities. What it says is that if the product or service is on the procurement list, if the qualified rehab facility can meet timeline specifications, etc., then the public agency is required to negotiate with them and see if they can reach an agreement to provide the product or service. It doesn't mandate it. In fact, less than 2% of all public contracts are negotiated under this law. We don't have a very big piece of the pie, and in respect to all those contracts, we're not a very big piece of the action. We are a comparatively small labor force. It's a very important labor force, but in the grand scheme of things, it is not that large. None of the changes that are in 684 or 708 or the amended 684 are simple or benign. All of them would restrict access to work by people with disabilities. All of them would set up barriers compared to the current law. And contrary to what I heard last week, there have been no statute changes since the law was introduced. Neither the target population is defined by what's a disability, nor any other aspect of the law has changed since it was introduced. There has been no disability creep. There has been no change in policy. As I listened to last week's testimony, I heard the same concerns that I have heard for the last 2 or 3 years from these individuals. The timeline that we've got goes back to 1987 in a regular session when a bill was introduced that would specifically have prohibited one particular nonprofit from providing mail services to the state. It simply prohibited the state from contracting with a nonprofit for mail services. It was that direct. That tactic didn't work, but what we've seen is that they have broadened the whole approach to, well, let's change the law then. We, like Roger, have really no objection to the business community raising concerns. They should be able to raise concerns and be responded to. We feel they have been over and over again. I know Senator Duncan was chair of an interim committee. Senator Fisher, you were chair of an interim committee last interim that looked at some of these issues. Department of Administrative Services looked at these issues. They were responded to. The business community continues to come back, we feel, because they don't like the answers they've had. Nothing, in our opinion, has been found that substantiates or requires a change in the law. The program has been operating 22 years, and yes, there are issues that need to be addressed. In fact, the committee that Representative Loken convened, which includes businesses, includes us, includes DOS, is making recommendations that will tighten up administration of the law. It makes administrative rule changes. The Secretary of State audit that John Yunker, the head of DOS, requested at the request of the business community, is going to make recommendations as well that will require administrative rule changes. That doesn't surprise me. I don't think it would surprise you either. I don't know of any state agency that escapes the Secretary of State audit without recommendations. However, it does not require opening the law. It does require administrative rule changes. Nothing that has been found has shown any evidence of fraud or intentional misuse. And I agree with Roger. These bills, with or without amendments, are disguised attempts to put up barriers and to restrict competition. We respectfully request the committee not vote these bills out. We have reviewed the 3-inch thick binder that you received last week, and primarily it's a history lesson. It's documentation that is of what has happened. It's kind of like our timeline, only it has the actual documents included. We didn't find anything of merit in there. And we've looked at the new amendments as proposed in 684, the 18 pages that were dropped on us last week. While that the changes are too numerous and too time-consuming for me to walk through point by point, I'd simply like to make you aware of the fact that those amendments have real fiscal impact on DOS and other aspects of the state, and that if enacted, they would restrict access to employment for people with disabilities. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions. If not, Bob Russell from the Oregon Disabilities Commission is here as well with me.
Tim, you indicated there have been no change in policies and no change in definitions of disabilities.
Yes, sir.
But there does seem to be at least some evidence, I believe, that the Older American Act has at least a tendency to lean toward a heavier disability than perhaps at least some of the job application advertising and stuff like that would indicate.
The Older American Act, or the Americans with Disabilities?
Ms. Fulkerson,
yes.
Thank you.
Americans with Disabilities Act, Senator Fisher, members of the committee. I'd like to call your attention to this chart that we've handed out. This was developed not at our request. This was developed by the committee that Representative Loken convened in a session headed by Molly Holstaffel, who's in the audience today, who's currently with the Oregon Developmental Disability Services and was with Vocational Rehabilitation for many years. The larger circle is the voc rehab definition of disability, and it encompasses a variety of specific disabilities who are also served by other parts of the state, developmental disabilities, visually impaired, psychiatric disabilities. There are other disabilities as well, brain injury, physical disabilities, etc. The definition, the little asterisk at the bottom, the definition of disability that's used in the Products of Disabled Individuals Law is encompassed by the vocational rehabilitation definition because it says not able to be fully competitively employed, and that's the crux of voc rehab's definition. This has to be attested to by someone certified to diagnose a disability, and as Senator Duncan referred last week, I don't, when the Attorney General signs off on opinion, he's taking responsibility for it. When a physician or other person qualified to certify disability signs off, I don't think he's going to, or she is going to, put their license on the line simply because somebody wants to be deemed disabled for the purposes of this law. We don't make that determination. Qualified rehabilitation facilities don't make that determination. The people who make that determination are certified by the state to do such, and it's in the files. And as Roger attested, none of the investigations by DOS or anybody else have ever shown that there was a problem with people who were masquerading as disabled or that there wasn't a sufficient percentage of labor hours.
I guess either I don't understand your answer or your answer didn't.
ADA has nothing to do with the definition in the law nor in voc rehab's definition. The Americans with Disabilities Act definition exists. It's a federal definition. It's not one used by our law. So I suppose you could be disabled under the Americans with Disabilities Act for federal purposes and not eligible for this law, because that includes such things as perception of a disability. If you think you're disabled, you could be considered disabled under the ADA. That wouldn't work here. That wouldn't work under our law. A physician or certified person has to say, you're not fully competitively employable, and I attest to it, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, I didn't answer that directly.
Okay. Go ahead. Senator Fisher, a member of the committee. My name is Bob Rucker. I'm a commissioner on the Oregon Disability Commission. The Oregon Disability Commission has gone on record to support the state youth law and oppose any effort to loosen it. People with disability are in a high unemployment category. They need all the help they can get to find jobs. I know from my own personal experience, as well as experience of other deaf and hard of hearing people and other disability people, how hard it is to find jobs. We feel that we have a strike against us before we even go out looking for a job. Many of them have just given up and are on SSL or SSDL. QRF gives disabled people an opportunity to become employed. They provide counseling, support, and through the state youth law, access to state jobs. It is important to keep the word disabled in the language of the state use law so that it will be available to all people with disability. I and the Oregon Disability Commission encourage the committee to keep the state use law as it is and vote no on Senate Bill 684 and Senate Bill 708. Thank you.
Are there any questions of the witnesses?
I'd like to point out that the Oregon Disabilities Commission is a state-appointed commission that represents all disabilities, and we're very pleased to have their support.
Thank you. I was talking to Senator Duncan here. I think we're going to go back and forth between positive and negative witnesses. Well, for and against the bill, excuse me. So in that case, you're negative. You're against the bill. But we have Sandra Bishop Jerry Edgar?
Edgar.
And Paul
Edgar.
Negative. Are they here?
Paul shaking his head.
We do have a lot of people to go this morning, so I want to keep moving as fast as we can, please. So let's try to give each table, well, at this rate, each table should get about 10 minutes, okay?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop, and I...
Sure, I'm just going to say, if people have written testimony, I would hope that they would supply that way so I can read, and if they would just highlight things, that would really help.
Here's Senator Duncan's perspective.
Yes.
So,
Chair Shields, Senator Duncan, we will do that. We're not going to be using... Go ahead and pass it down. And then wait and pass it down. We're not necessarily going to be reading through our whole testimony. We'd like to give some high points and address some of the major concerns that we've been talking about. I'd like to first just take a moment to introduce the people that are with me today. On my left, I have my assistant, Emily Robertson. She's here so we can facilitate getting this stuff up to you, and she has the background you may need. And to my right is the person who's going to present a lot of the testimony today, which is Jerry Ager. He owns a business here in Salem. He's also the president of the board of directors. And just so you can get some idea of who's here, I'm going to go ahead and embarrass all of our members. If all of the people that are here with the Fair Competition Alliance, would you please stand? And I'd just like to say that you have here today representatives from three or four major industries that are affected by this. And we are all here with a clear mission statement in mind, and that is that the Fair Competition Alliance is set up to further the purposes of this law. We are not attempting to weaken this law in any way. We're attempting to strengthen it to assure that the severely disabled in the state of Oregon are employed and to allow private businesses in the state the opportunity to hire some of the disabled people with lesser disabilities. So we're definitely not here to weaken anything. We would not be here if that were the case. So I just want to make that clear. You have the notebooks that we've given you before. I'm going to go ahead and pass out some more additional documents that go in those notebooks. I'd like to draw particular attention to one of the documents that's in there, and we're also giving you a corrected and made some additions to the table of contents. The third document from the back that set is a recently released document that came out from the Secretary of State Audit Division Office. And this is a very interesting document, and this goes to the heart of what we're talking about here today. Basically, we would not be here. You would not be having these kind of discussions if there weren't problems in this public contracting program. The intention of the program, as it was set up in 77, is very clear that it was set up with the severely disabled in mind in order to provide employment for the severely disabled. What has happened over the years, and it does relate to the Americans with Disabilities Act, only in that over the years, the definition of disability has changed. It has changed on a national level. As you can tell, there are four Supreme Court cases right now discussing definition of disability. No one is going to the Supreme Court saying the definition of disability hasn't changed in 20 years. It's changed drastically. And in direct relationship to this public contracting law, that definition has been systematically changed. The attempt has been made to systematically change it. The documentation is in the notebook. It can't get more clear. 5 years ago, Goodwill Industries of Columbia Willamette specifically asked the Workers' Compensation Division to look at the possibility of putting a very specific definition of disabled worker in the law. If there was a problem 5 years ago, you can bet, and you can see there's a bigger problem today. And what has happened is that this program, the emphasis in this program for public contracts has shifted away from the mission to provide employment for disabled individuals. They shifted away from that into a program which is being used as an economic development tool in the state. You need to be asking for hard numbers. We are a private coalition of businesses. We cannot access the data from private nonprofit corporations operating in the state, and we can't access the data from the Oregon Rehab Association. But you need to be asking the tough question, how many people with disabilities are being employed on these million-dollar contracts, and how many people with severe disabilities are being employed? And I'll just cut to the chase, the very end of my testimony, to say that I think the challenge and the opportunity for the legislature is to clear the waiting list. And in the notebook, there, it's under tab number 26, is a long-range plan that was done in 1996. And this talks about the kind of waiting list that the people have been on. I have heard horror stories about people who want to better their family's condition, but they can't move out of a geographic area because their child, who is eligible for a work program, is on one of those waiting lists and has been on the list for several years and has gotten up the list a little bit. So family's afraid to leave the area because they'll go to a new area and they'll be put on the bottom of a waiting list. There's no reason, with a booming economy, with multi-million dollar contracts out there, that those people should be on that waiting list. Those are the kind of people you need to be looking for. Why doesn't this public contracting law employ the people with the most severe disability? And our contention is to shift over time away from the people with severe disabilities. It's very difficult to employ those people. And let me just jump quickly to the other end of the spectrum. The people with lesser disabilities who are being employed under these set-aside public contracts, it's the same labor pool from which my members draw their employees. And they cannot hire those people because of the skewed market position that the nonprofit large corporations have. There are a lot of, I'm going to just say, there are a lot of small nonprofits out in the states who are doing wonderful, running wonderful programs employing the severely disabled. But you're not hearing from them. You've never heard from a small nonprofit. You're only hearing from the people that are running with large, major corporate nonprofits that are holding literally millions of dollars in contracts. So I would just say that look at the pieces of the picture that you're getting and try to keep an open mind. And I would challenge you and say that it's not that difficult. You should be able to clear the waiting list and employ all the severely disabled people. Right now, the severely disabled people of Oregon are being exploited to create economic gain for major corporate nonprofits in the state. I'd be more than happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I'd like to move on.
Would you prefer that we come back up?
No, I want to get as much testimony as I can, and I am committed to going back and forth.
Okay. For the record, my name is Jerry Egger of the Fair Competition Alliance. I'm also the owner of Mid Valley Freefront Mailing in Salem, Oregon. Pardon my voice, I got that cold today. I'm not going to repeat testimony that I gave last week. I'd like to go in and really focus this morning on, I have a few visual aids that I'd like to show you and kind of explain about the program. In terms of specific needs for clarification of the definition of disabled, last week we offered an affidavit of an individual that worked at a local QRF, and the document specified possible violations and abuses, but most importantly, it is a striking example of the need for clarification of not only the target population intended to be served, but also the lack of an objective, impartial, and effective monitoring and enforcement system.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I have a quick question.
Yes.
That affidavit, I have read it. Did someone file a complaint with us on that particular situation? And have they dealt with it? It's in process. Okay.
I apologize. Mr. Shilb, Senator Duncan. Yes, the complaint was filed in March of 1998, specifically based on the contention. The Department of Administrative Services replied in April of 1998, saying that they had done their own investigation. This was the purchasing department of the Transportation Print Services Division. They had done their own internal looking at it. There's absolutely no problem. We wrote back and said, there is a problem, and is there any appeal process? They said, no. If you'd like to appeal, you can appeal to the person who was the purchasing contracting specialist who said there was no problem. Then we have a letter that was written within that same time frame to the executive director, John Yonker, asking for a resolution that has, we have never received an answer. Right, we've never received an answer. That's still open.
Senator Duncan, the intent of, we were trying to understand how the system operated. We didn't want to believe that those types of activities could go on. We wanted to make this presumption that there was adequate oversight. The first exhibit is essentially page 4 of the QRF application form that's submitted to ODAS. And this form as per ODAS's comments, is essentially an application certification form that the QRS are required to submit every 3 years. On line one, you'll see the definition is clear, severely disabled. A nonprofit sheltered workshop or activity center organized under the laws of the United States of America and the state of Oregon and operating in the interest of severely disabled individuals. And then on line three, it's very clear during the fiscal year employs severely disabled individuals for not less than 75% of the man hours of direct labor. That's the first item. So as a business operator or owner trying to understand the definition of disabled individual, if that's the documents that an entity must submit in order to get approval to get preferential treatment on state contracts, we're desperately trying to understand what exactly that means. The other item that was brought up in testimony, in prior testimony, was an example of the state of Oregon and the federal Javits-Wagner OJ Act. Not that one. Yeah, didn't. Not that one. In terms of in the initial study, in trying to evaluate comparisons between the federal Javits-Wagner OJ Act and the state law, those are the side-by-side comparison with 41 CFR versus 279.835. In the Oregon definition, it basically is a disabled individual means an individual who, because of the nature of disability, is not able to participate fully in competitive employment and for whom specialized employment opportunities must be provided. The federal definition, on the other hand, clearly points out there are two items. Item one refers to the blind individuals, and the item two refers to other severely handicapped and severely handicapped individuals. There are other issues. In attempting to come up with five or six major points to point out some differences, the first being disabled individual versus blind and other severely disabled individuals, they seem very different on the surface, but I have another visual aid that I'm going to put up to hopefully try and clarify it and get closer to at least what our understanding is of the definition under the statute. The second major item, the federal law is very different in terms of capability assessments and using competitive employment definitions such as you have in your handout on the state-federal comparison, which is item 14 in your handout. The other major differences in terms of the procurement list or suitability that's stated in the statute. In actuality, before an item can be added to the federal list, there needs to be a suitability study, and in some cases an independent staff or employment engineer by the central nonprofit agency would have to present to the committee whether or not that product or service is capable of being performed or provided by the entities in the program. Items to the JWD Act are added on a case-by-case, location-by-location basis. Items must demonstrate the potential to generate employment for blind or severely disabled individuals. ODAS allows all products or services QRS produced to be included in the procurement list. The other major difference from the business standpoint is the JWD Act actually considers the level of impact on the current contractor. for the commodity or service, as well as allows a public comment period for interested parties. The other item that's probably very interesting in terms of the differentiation, the JWD committee is a separate entity within the federal government. It is run by 18 people, which oversees approximately 30,000 people, and that's according to General Counsel Hire of the JWD committee. And its sole purpose is to employ people with severely disabled individuals, blind and other severely disabled individuals. In contrast, although I think it's important as well to anybody in administering this program within the state to work closely with the nonprofit community, in some cases, this past year or two, it becomes very cloudy whether or not ODAS is truly objective. The other major difference, one of the major differences, is the application and compliance procedures, whereas the state of Oregon, an application or certification, depending upon your point of view, has been submitted every 3 years. In the JWD Act, the initial application is submitted, and then there's an annual filing thereafter.
Jerry, we're going to have to ask you to finish up in about 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay.
So, make it quick, and I apologize for hurrying things along.
This is a document that was submitted by the senior underwriter, per se, 4 years ago when they were talking about what to include in a workers' compensation refund. There was discussions about disability. And there's Sandra referred to, Ms. Bishop referred to a document of goodwill requesting a clarification of disability. In this statute, which is 344.511, I apologize for this, but it's disabled individual means any person who has a substantial occupational handicap due to a physical or mental condition. And there's definitely severely handicapped individual definition. And I'm going to read it for you. Severely handicapped individual means the disabled individual who, because of the nature of disabilities, is not able to participate fully in competitive employment, and some specialized employment opportunities must be provided. That blow up of the two, and I guess that's my confusion, and that's confusion of the Fair Competition Alliance, is that it's exactly the same wording. And I would defer to the experts. I'm not an expert in disability. I'm just a small business person trying to understand the law. But perhaps somebody from Vocational Rehabilitation Division could come up and explain. I moved the words a little bit. But in fact, disabled individual for purposes of this statute is because of the nature of disabilities, which is actually identical to the severely handicapped individual in 344.511. Beneficiary, I think that was 2 minutes. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Fisher, if it's possible, I'd like to just quickly address a couple of points that were brought up earlier. For the record, again, it's Sandra Bishop for the Fair Competition Alliance. There were three quick points I wanted to go over and refer you to. Please carefully look at the archives in under tab number 31. The original legislation proposed by Representative Frohnmayer in 1977 recommended an independent committee to do exactly in Oregon exactly what's done at the federal level, well, not exactly, but to have an independent oversight function in Oregon. What was the equivalent of Department of Administrative Services, I think of GAS, the General Administration Services at that time, asked that be taken out. I think that you need to look carefully and you need to hear from the Department of Administrative Services people about why they are not, because of lack of resources, able to implement this law. So they've tried it. It's not working. They said, well, at the time, General Services said, we don't need this independent council. We'll just do it ourselves. If you read even just the first page of the Secretary of State's Audit Division letter, it very clearly states that the Department of Administrative Services is not implementing the law. And then also, the fiscal impact is that was kind of thrown out as a contingent that there's some great fiscal impact to this. please understand there's a lot of money in this public contracting system. And the Dash 1 Amendment to 684 simply called for a small surcharge on those contracts. And it might be useful to ask the people from the Oregon Rehabilitation Association how they're funded at this point. I have, you know, second and third hand information, people telling me that, sure, that the association already takes that surcharge out. So we're thinking there's no need for public money. The third, just very important point, is made this in reference to a committee that's been convened by Representative Loken. That is not true. There is no committee. It is simply an informal, without any sanction, it's an informal task group, and it was specifically set up to look at the DAS reporting requirements, and that's all that committee was set up to do. And it's not a committee, it's just an informal work group, so I hope that you'll not be misled to think that there's someone else working on this. The decision really lies with the people. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, go ahead and call others.
Catherine White and Renee Rutledge.
While they're coming up, I just wanted to say that I screwed it up. I was trying to go back and forth between opponents and proponents. I asked Sandra to try to keep it to 10 minutes. I think with a view to fairness, since they went for 23 minutes, the opponents now ought to have 23 minutes, regardless of how many tables come up. I think we ought to try to keep this as balanced as possible.
Go ahead, Renee. It doesn't matter who goes first.
Okay. For the record, my name is Renee Rutledge. I'm Assistant Administrator for Planning and Policy at the Vocational Rehabilitation Division, and I've provided you with copies of my written testimony. I think you've got a lot of people in the audience who want to speak to you who are really close to this issue, and what I'd like to do is just give you a couple of overview comments, and if you have any questions directly of me. I think it really gets down, we are opposed to both Senate Bill 684 and Senate Bill 708. Our opposition really rests with not wanting to have the distinction that some people are starting to try to develop between people with disabilities and people with severe disabilities and people with the most god-awful severe disabilities. And I say that as a person with a disability that is really just angry that this is the level of discussion that we're having. The discussion we need to have is about the employment of people with disabilities, and it should be without regard to the labels that we place on people. And when we start to place a qualified rehabilitation facility in the role of having to differentiate between people with disabilities and people with severe disabilities and the most severe disabilities, then what you've done is place them in a position where they have to go back to those individuals and try to query, so how disabled are you? How severely disabled are you? And I've got to tell you, as a person with a disability, that's inhumane. And I would ask you to not go there, that the language that's in the statute now works for this program. This is a program that state agencies benefit from. We are able to utilize the products and services of people with disabilities and do business with these organizations who have taken on the responsibility of creatively identifying ways to employ people with disabilities. To go the direction of trying to differentiate by definition of who is a person with a disability or a severe disability, or whether or not 75% of the direct labor work is done by people with disabilities, is one of the things that I would ask you not to do, because what we've said in this program is that we have a tremendous amount of oversight that happens because most of the organizations that do the state youth program are members of NISH, the National Industry for the Severely Handicapped. They do live within the constraints that Sandra Bishop was just describing to you about the JWAD program. These are organizations that have taken on the responsibility of making a very complex system of definitions work, and what they've done is put people to work. And I would ask you to not think lightly that just by going in and saying, well, let's just make sure the program is for people with severe disabilities, that this will cause this issue to go away. What we want to do is make sure that people with disabilities become employed, and this program is doing that, and state government and state agencies benefit from this. It's good public policy, and I would encourage you to listen intensely to all of the discussion that's gone on, but to recognize that changing this program is not the right decision to make. Thank you.
May I would just have to say, right now, it's not my intent to lessen the amount of jobs available. I'm very much in support of having folks with disabilities have access to jobs and encourage them and to make what they potentially can do reasonably to accommodate their needs.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say this, you have to make some tough decisions. And when the state money is involved and state things are doing, you have to ask people. And it's not inhumane. Any more than it's inhumane to ask me how tall I am and how much I weigh if I want to be an Air Force pilot. The fact is, the way those aircraft are made, I can't get in. And so I guess that could be a disability. But they have a right, I believe, to ask, and they need to get people in there that can function and do the job. And there's certain things that you need to do. And when we're working with state money, we need to make it go as far as we possibly can and help those that don't have any other way of having a job as much as we possibly can. And there are those of us that maybe have a disability of height or size or some things, but we still can go out and reasonably find jobs. And that's what I'm trying to do, and I'm not trying to be inhumane to anyone or anything else, but we have a responsibility to the citizen of the state, to the taxpayer, and to the folks with disabilities, and to the folks without disabilities to make things run as smoothly as possible and do the best job we can. And the best way in the world, when there's accusations flying around all over the place, when there's witness and affidavits made and things like that, we best get to the bottom of them and put a stop to them if we can. If they're not true, we best get there and ferret it out. And that's what we're trying to do. So please don't infuse too many things into us about being down on folks with disabilities, because probably somewhere under the height of each one of us, we have some kind of disability.
And I respect that kind of issue.
Yes, not in physical up here.
Thank you.
But anyway, I won't go there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White. Today I'm here representing the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition, and this is a coalition of the major advocacy groups, disability advocacy groups in Oregon, the Arc of Oregon, Arc of Multnomah, the Oregon Advocacy Center, the United Cerebral Palsy of Oregon and Southwest Washington, and the Oregon Rehab Association and the Residential Providers Association. And we just wanted to express our concern and opposition to Senate Bill 684 and 708. As Oregon, we frankly consider the product of the disabled individual law as an essential part of public policy in Oregon for people with developmental disabilities. And as we close our state institution, largest state institution, we are looking to expand jobs, not limit them. As a coalition, we've looked at some of the accusations, and we really believe that there has been sufficient oversight in public bodies, committee hearings, the AG's office review of the law, and everything that we see indicates that this law is working, that it's working well, and it is achieving the public policy objective that we feel are important, and we strongly recommend that the committee reject any amendments.
David, Stephen, or writing? Stephen, second.
Good morning.
All right.
Chairman Fisher and members of the committee, my name is David Wiegand. I'm the executive director of Mid Valley Rehabilitation. We're located primarily in Yamhill County. And I apologize, I don't have written testimony, and I'll explain why in a minute. But I want to start by I'm not going to take too long, but I'm going to start by explaining why I'm here. I'm in the Oregon Rehab Association. I've been in for a long time. And I've been in this business for 22 years. I've worked with people with disabilities for 22 years in Oregon. In a county mental health program for the United Cerebral Palsy Association, now for Nidal Rehabilitation. And I'm here, frankly, because I wasn't even going to come until last night. And my conscience has been bothering me. And I think I just can't ignore the fact that I don't think you're hearing the whole truth. I think you're hearing things that are true, but I don't think you're hearing the whole truth about this matter. And that's why I'm here. I've worked with people with disabilities for all these years. I've served as a Special Olympics coach. I've been a board member for ARC. I've done lots and lots of volunteer things. I absolutely 100% believe in what we do, and I absolutely 100% believe in the value of the products of the disabled law, and I am here for it, not against it. But I think it does have some flaws. And I think that I'm going to try to focus on a concept, if you will, an idea about why it has a flaw. For me, the analogy that I use is if you go in for a bank loan and you fill out your application, and then it has a bottom line on it where you are asked if you approve your own application for your bank loan. As it stands right now, and as the law is being used, that's pretty much how it works. And by that I mean we've seen a tremendous increase, primarily in the last 5 years. The numbers of dollars that have gone into this program in the last 5 years have virtually doubled. I mean, it's up to $30 million. In 1990, I think it was at 7 or something like that. And it's just expanded tremendously. And, I've wondered, well, why is that? And one of the things that bothers me the most is that for people who are going into it, and for some of the programs, I believe that the vast majority of the programs out there and the organizations that are working within this law are doing it correctly, and there's no problem. I really think it's a wonderful law, and it's serving a wonderful purpose. It is excellent. But I think in some cases it's not being used correctly, and I think that the reason for that is because of that analogy that I used. We're asking people to do something that I think is very difficult and goes against human nature. We're asking them to say, let's turn this money away and let's not use this money, and instead let's just ignore it. For people who are being qualified to come in under this law, basically, we're asking right now the qualified rehab organizations to make that determination. And I just don't think that's right. I think that somebody outside of the organization should make the determination of eligibility.
Peter? Yes, ma'am. I don't quite clearly understand your point there. Well, I don't understand.
Right now, as it stands, if somebody wants to go to work under the products of the disabled law, they apply to the QRF, and the QRF makes the determination whether or not they are, in fact, quote, disabled or not. In essence, they do, because they're brought a certificate from, a letter from a doctor or something like that, and I don't think that those people are in the position to make the determination about competitive employment eligibility. They're in the position to make an expert opinion about whether or not the person has a condition or just some medical situation. In order for it to be objective, it should really be an outside party. And so, in the part of the law the amendments here to the law that I believe are appropriate are that it would be determined by someone outside of the organization. In other words, the Developmental Disabilities Office, as it's done now for eligibility for DD, they make that determination. eligibility within the state vocational rehabilitation department, so that they would make the determination whether or not the person is eligible for this benefit. This is really a benefit. And in a couple of others, and I think that way it puts it out so that there's a temptation there right now to bend and to bend a long ways to get people included. And the problem that I have with it and why I'm here today is because about a year ago, somebody in one of these organizations, I was talking to him and I said, well, you know, how are things going? He said, well, you know, one by one, we're ending our services to people with developmental disabilities. You know, we've got so many contracts now. We've added so many contracts under the Products of the Disabled Law that it's just not worth the time. It's not lucrative working with people with developmental disabilities. And so one by one, they're ending services to them. And there are 3,000, according to the state, there are 3,500 people with developmental disabilities, people who are the most in need in our state, who are waiting for services. And I have dealt with a lot of those families, and they're waiting. And they are not to my knowledge, I haven't heard any evidence at all that these people are being taken off that waiting list and being employed. There may be some, I'm sure there's some. But in general, I don't think this is happening at all. And I really think that this is an injustice to those people. I think it's a misuse of the resources of the state. And I think if we define the target population and push those resources towards those people and people who also have severe disabilities, the target population for whom I absolutely believe this law is intended, I think the system as a whole will be much, much better. I am here in favor of this law and protecting it. And I think if it goes on unchanged and without defining why we're here, I think in time it is going to suffer tremendously.
Let's cut to the chase a minute. Are you in favor of Senate Bill 684?
I'm in favor of the part that includes the definitions that were listed in the amendments in that target population. That's the part that I'm in favor of. I'm not sure about that, an independent commission. It sounds like another level of bureaucracy.
Don't you think that it's possible that if the law as it's presently structured isn't working, it's because people aren't applying the law as carefully as they should rather than going to a new law? I mean, for instance, this certification of somebody with a disability by a doctor, that ought to be tightened up so that doctors don't willy-nilly send these notes out like hall passes at a high school or something. Follow what I'm saying?
Exactly. And I believe that virtually anybody, if they tried long enough over the next couple of weeks, could get some doctor somewhere to give them a certificate and get them qualified under this program. I could be.
But the point is, the doctor should be risking his license. It's not the problem with the law, it's the problem with the application of the law.
Correct. I just don't think they understand what it is that they're certifying people for.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I know we've got to move along because we haven't. I thought we were going to hear from Dobbs and Gretton today.
Yes, we are.
I'll ask a quick question here. I had said that I'm opposed to these particular bills, but I am, and I, you know, I chaired an independent committee dealing with this whole issue. And I said at that time, and I still stand on that premise, I would support an audit. You know, I served on the Legislative Audits Committee, and I would support doing a full-fledged audit because I think we ought to be following the law. I have no problem with the current law, and it should be followed. Would that satisfy some of your concerns if we ask for an independent audit?
I think that would in part, but I think the part about having QRS make their own determinations and whether or not people meet criteria, I just think
that's
we just don't do that anywhere else, except this is about the only place I can see something like that where you self-approve whether or not people meet the criteria. I just think that's a conflict of interest that's built into this law as it is now, and I just think it's bad business practice, and I think it's bad social service practice as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to call Grossman.
And Al Davidson and Ken.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Al Davidson. I'm currently the president of the board of directors of Garten Services. I understand the need to be speedy here, so I'll be very brief. I'm not going to talk directly to the bill, so you may want to tell me to shut up. But you have been provided quite a bit of information that relates specifically to Garten Services. And my purpose here today is to let you know that the board of directors at Garten Services is mightily upset over some of the allegations that have been made. Most of them are a rehash of information that was submitted and pretty much discounted by the interim committees. They're half-truths, non-truths, and sometimes totally false statements. And I wanted to assure you that the board of directors of Garten Services, which is made up of 17 community leaders, myself, I'm the county clerk for Marion County, in my 16th year of doing that. Before that, I was the executive assistant to some obscure elected official that had something, state elected official that had something to do with schools.
My speeches for 7 years.
But our board of directors also has attorneys, accountants, local business people. We're not just a bunch of local yokels that get led around by the staff. We have a benchmark and performance committee that we have created that's headed by Jim Scherzinger, who's a former legislative fiscal officer here, a man who knows his way around performance issues. The charge of that committee, Mr. Scherzinger, is to audit the issue of whether or not we're complying with the state law, and in fact, in every month we are exceeding the requirements of state law. And I just want to assure this committee that we have a great deal of local oversight of the operations of Garten Services, regardless of the information you've been provided, which most of it is false. This is in addition to the state and federal audits that we go through, and Senator Duncan, I would say that at Garten Services, on behalf of the Board of Directors, we would welcome any audit you want to bring on. We'll stand ready at any time. Mr. Graziani is going to talk about the specifics of this bill and its impact on what we do at Garten, but I wanted to make those comments on behalf of the Board of Directors, and if the committee has questions of me related to that, I'd be happy to respond to them. So thank you for the opportunity.
I would hope that Mr. Graziani would at least make some reference to the, I can't remember the number in here, but the Martina Cortez.
Number 20, yeah.
Okay.
You could respond to that. Senator Fisher, Senator Duncan, my name is Emil Graziani. For the record, I'm the Executive Director for Garten Services. I've been with the organization since 1975, and it's the Executive Director since 1978. Senator Duncan, I wasn't prepared to go into depth on that. I didn't want to waste your time, but I do have prepared remarks for you that I can certainly give to you. I thought that the allegations, the affidavit, not worth taking your time. The question seems to be, why wasn't information shared with DAS last February when we were audited in March by DAS, and that information might have come in handy then. So, but anyway, you have a response to those remarks there. I've been actively involved in the field, as I said, for the last 23, 24 years. I was involved in this bill in 1977 when the Parts and Disabled Law was passed unanimously by this this body. And I'm here to speak against both bills. My question is, why change something that's working? And in other words, is it benefiting the people that it was supposed to benefit, and at what cost to taxpayers?
Could you possibly pick out the things that you have that are different from what already has been specified? I prefer not to go over and over the same.
Okay. Let me just make a few remarks then of what I think you heard already this morning. You were asked to find out how many people are employed in these $1 million contracts. You have that information. It's supplied to you. That is a rabbit trail to go down. That information is documented and available to you. This affidavit that was shared with you last week, that that information should have been shared with DAS so they could investigate those charges 14 months ago. You heard this morning about FTA members can't hire people with severe disabilities. Why not? My organization employs 275 people with disabilities. 174 of them are people with developmental disabilities, and the remainder are people with severe and persistent mental illness. 50% of the individuals in our organization have spent 20 or more years in an institution in Oregon. You might assume that those people already are severely disabled, but what about the other 50% that hadn't been confined that long? Behind me, with me today, is a woman, Margaret Taylor, and her adult child, Linda, who's in our mail services building. Margaret and her husband, Mike, are some of the brave, courageous people in Oregon who have kept their disabled individual out of the institution. Because she wasn't in an institution, is she not disabled? This issue of, is there a definition and where are we going with the definition exists? There is a definition, the law works. This is a smokescreen in order to get at this particular organization by two members of the FCA. Mr. Kroll referred to one attempt in 1997. There was another attempt in the 1980s in recycling to stop the state from doing business with garden and recycling. Get to the heart of the matter. The law works. Let the administrative rules be revised in committee someplace or ask DAS to deal with administrative rules, but I don't think the committee needs to change the law and lessen its effect. And I'll stop where you are here.
I want to ask you a couple of questions because we do have an affidavit here, an article when it was given. Not about this brief over, but it wasn't given a year ago or 6 months ago or whenever it was supposed to have been over, this signed affidavit. We brush it off as untruth. Are you notified about inspections from DAS ahead of time?
Am I notified about an inspection? The state does not usually walk into us without calling somebody and saying we're coming over to inspect you or to visit you or we want to see something. We are in operation. I have invited them personally to do that. You have a letter to that effect that says the doors are open anytime. You don't need to call. But yes, we are notified, not necessarily a week in advance, that they're going to come by. But I might also add the JWAD does the exact same thing. They call 2 months in advance when they do their inspections of our program. The federal government does inspections of the program and saying we're coming out on this date. Here's the outline of the things we want to see. Be prepared to show those to us. So yes, sir, Senator Fisher, we are notified in advance.
That's certainly a handy situation because I can name a whole bunch of professions that would love to have that same consideration and don't get it. And our staff is expected to be there regardless of what hour they walk in. Now they're even talking about doing a certain amount of night inspections unknown. So the night staff, which is not in general having access to the office information and that kind of thing, are not there.
Senator Fisher, may I address that? You asked me if we were notified of inspections by DAS, and I said yes. There is another agency of the state, the Mental Health Division, who administers abides by administrative rules for serving people with developmental disabilities who come in unannounced. And I think these are the people you're referring to. You may have them from the Senior Services Division. We have them from the Developmental Disability Services Division who come in to do their inspections of us without notifying us in advance to make sure that our records are abiding by administrative rules, a myriad of government regulations that we have to follow, and they do come in unannounced. But DAS and the Products of Disabled Law has notified us in order to be prepared to share the records. There are times, I'm sure, in your organization too, that that people who may not normally be there need to be there to open up those records, assigning people to show payroll, administrators, case managers, things like that. And we also have multiple locations there.
There were significant accusations in here about getting mailed by machine and billing beforehand mail and giving false information out to clients concerning the status of their mailings, what process they were in, part of the process they were in, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Senator Fisher, that statement is absolutely false. The machine produces the invoice. You cannot say you processed the mail and invoice the customer and not have the mail processed because the machine generates the information from which you bill from. So the statement is a lie. It's literally impossible. It produces a daily run at the end of the night. You cannot say you ran it, invoice it, when it's you can't hand it's not possible to do it by hand. And I do have our mailroom manager if you want to have some really specific details about that alteration in the audience.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Senator Fisher, distinguished members of the committee, my name is Ken Fosham. I'm the executive director of CCI Enterprises, a nonprofit social service program headquartered in Milwaukee. I'm here on behalf of our volunteer board of directors and those we serve to oppose both these bills, 684 and 708. We provide, much like Garten Services, services for a variety of adults with disabilities, most of whom are mentally retarded and developmentally disabled. We serve about 180 people, mostly in the Southeast Portland metropolitan area. We are also a qualified rehabilitation facility for the purposes of the Products of the Disabled Law. We have a state contract to produce rubber stamps for the state and the political subdivisions. This year, that particular project will probably do a little less than $150,000 worth of business, something like that. So contrary to Ms. Bishop's statement that you're not hearing from the small businesses that perform under the QRF, you are right now. We have a small contract, and I assure you that it does not line our pockets. It loses money every year, but we keep doing it because it employs people with disabilities. Last year, we were selected by the North Clackamas Chamber of Commerce as the Chamber's Business of the Year. And I bring this to your attention not because we're a great business. We're not making millions of dollars like Microsoft or anyone. But the Chamber and other businesses recognize the important benefits that organizations like ours bring to the community and the partnerships that we create with them, not as adversaries, but as partners. And they feel that's very important. And they've given us that award because of our mission in the community and because they are very actively involved with that mission. The Products of the Disabled Law basically does the same thing. It creates partnerships with the state, with political subdivisions, with our community rehabilitation programs, and ultimately benefiting the disabled. We really feel that the law itself should be given some kind of compliment as a special award of the Business of the Year, a special project of the year, something that it does incredible things for disabled people in Oregon. I also agree with Emil's comments that, Mr. Krasjanin's comments, that if it's not broke, we shouldn't try and fix it. There may be some improvements that could be made. Again, we've had some allusions made to a committee that Representative Loken formed, whether formally or informally. There are some things that could be done, perhaps, in administrative rules or working with the Department of Administrative Services to fine-tune what we all expect out of this law, but certainly the law does not need to be rewritten or revised or opened for those purposes. In terms of the definitions, I would like to state that indeed we as community rehabilitation programs do not determine who is eligible, who is disabled, and who is not. That is determined by licensed, certified people that all of your state commissions license and certify. We simply are told who is disabled, and we go out of our way and do everything we can to serve them. And sometimes that's much more than any of you would consider reasonable. To make the our comments short, and just to follow up on a couple items that have already been made, As was noted earlier, this is really good public policy, the Products of the Disabled Law provides opportunities for hundreds of people across Oregon, but not only provides that employment, but it provides the state with a lot of very valuable goods and services they would have to produce anyway. And from the economic impact review that was done by the Oregon Association a few years ago, that returns a combined benefit in income tax receipts and reduced public supports of about 35%. So that's an incredibly positive benefit to the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, and something we all would want to retain. Again, if anything, and this was mentioned before by Lene Rutledge with the Vocational Rehabilitation Division, if anything, it would be really nice to be sitting here right now trying to figure out how we could maximize this law and be putting more people with disabilities to work rather than trying to attack something that's very functional and providing a lot of opportunity for people that would otherwise be in a group of 70% or more people, folks who are unemployed, sitting home and basically not doing much at all. I really do appreciate the Fair Competition Alliance's concern for our waiting list. It's really nice of them to address that. That's a very serious issue for all of us, a lot of people waiting for service. I really look forward to hearing their testimony through Ways and Means, and they're actually willing to step to the table and support us on those issues. There's been some discussion about replicating the federal process under which we would secure and maintain some of these projects under the state use law. I also have a federal contract. We make photo envelopes for the Defense Department so they can put all their spy photos someplace where they're not going to disintegrate, and I'll have them for years and years. It also is not a big project, but we do it because it provides employment for our people. But the bureaucratic jungle and the amount of paperwork we go through for that small project really is a disincentive in some respects to want to continue it. So, rather than creating a large bureaucratic structure which oversees all this program, let's try and do what we can to facilitate opportunities for people with disabilities. That's really pretty much the intent of my discussion, I guess. And I would like to just, in closing, quote the president of NISH, the national organization that helps provide opportunities for folks with disabilities through the Janus-Wagner Bay Act. Daniel McKinnon states, "Giving people a boost often requires special skills and a special organization talented in eliminating barriers, something commercial businesses may eschew. Successfully dealing with people with multiple barriers is the very special and historical forte of community rehabilitation programs. Giving up on people is not their business. Abandonment is not in the value set. Multiple barriers are hills to climb, not obstacles to avoid. We really need your help, Senators, in climbing that hill."
Thank you. Roseanne, just one comment here. I hope you didn't run your letter to us through the mailing machine. It's dated April 30th.
Mm-hmm.
Respectfully submitted 30th day of April, and I don't think it's that serious.
I think that's a little fishing up last night about 10:30, so I apologize for that.
Okay, I have a question because I think that everybody on both sides of the issue wants to give this fair and right and honest. And if I were in charge of auditing a company that said that they were using X number of disabled people, I would look at W-2 forms. I wouldn't go and see who's there at work on a certain day on a certain project. Have you ever, just to show that you're on top of the possible or not, or, the concerns, because it does seem unfair to the other side that you have foreknowledge, they're coming. Although I have a friend in daycare, and they always call to say when they're coming to inspect their daycare, the government. But, have you ever been audited by the powers that be looking at your W-2 forms and matching up who you say they have this disability and here's the hours they work, they pay taxes?
Senator Fisher, Senator Shannon, when NISH, the JWAC program, is audited, they track the client files and the hours worked back to the payroll, to the actual payroll record. So that process is done there. I
I don't recall for sure if the DAS follows that all the way back to payroll records.
And what are they looking? Who'd you say does that?
The JWAG program, when it's audited, it has a federal system.
And what does that stand for?
The Javits Wagner O'Day program.
Okay, does Javits Wagner O'Day have the same standards that this law has, 75%?
Yes, yes, Senator, it does. 75% direct labor. In fact, this law is modeled after that, the Javits Wagner O'Day law.
And are they on 75% of all work or 75% of each job?
Senator Fisher, Senator Duncan, it's 75% of the direct labor that's done for that, that's done in the whole organization.
So if another company that wanted to fairly compete with you could show that 75% of theirs, then they would have the same advantage as you. They wouldn't be held to a different standard. What I'm saying is they could have janitors sweeping and they could have the qualified disabled doing the same kind, and it would be fair.
Senator Fisher, I'm not sure I understand the question. When you say to be fair, if I understand, you're saying a for-profit organization, if they had 75% of the direct labor done in that organization, it would be fair for them to compete with a not-for-profit?
That's right. You're not-for-profit, and they're private.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not-for-profit.
Correct.
What do your profits sell?
Anything we make in a year, which is usually barely, goes back into the program to serve more people. For example, we serve a number of people that are not funded.
So if they turn this into a not-for-profit and their profit went to their wages, they would qualify?
No, there's a whole set of criteria they have to go through to do that.
Senator Fisher, Senator Shannon, I can address that also. There's been a lot of accusations about these millions of dollars of profit, and I think there was even a comment in the affidavit. I brought our tax return. Nonprofits have to do 990s. I brought the 990 for 1997 and 1998. I brought the financial statement for you that the board of directors approved. I can demonstrate to you through our tax return that's filed with the federal government that our organization does not make millions of dollars. In fact, in the last two fiscal years, we've had a loss on our operations. These accusations of millions of dollars being made off of state work is unfounded.
How come others can do it and turn a profit?
Senator Fisher, Senator Shannon, the organization I represent, Al Davidson, our board president, has made a commitment to serve as CCI has a lot of people who aren't funded through services. For instance, we raised money for the last 5 years to take people off the wait list. We've gone to the community to ask them to help us serve that wait list. Our organization's mission, we have two mission goals and one financial goal, and it is to make some money, because you can't grow a business without making some money.
Even a nonprofit.
If you don't have capital, you aren't growing. And unfortunately, what some of the things that have transpired, 2 years ago we lost a big piece of a contract that we had with the state of Oregon. It took $250,000 worth of revenues out of our operation. It really hurt. We had a hard time recovering from that. That's why we had some of the losses in the last 2 years. It's a tough business to run, and when you're doing it with a labor pool that has a lot of limitations, it's very, very difficult.
Thank you very much.
Mr.
Yes.
Maybe, I don't know if you addressed it, Mr. Graziani, when I was out of the room for a moment, but one of the previous speakers talked about the conflict of interest that the organizations like yours may have in being in a position of having to determine who's disabled when you're hiring people for your program. Could you speak to that issue? I know that you spoke to that. Thank you.
Senator Fisher, Senator Castillo, we don't find ourselves in that predicament. The individuals that come to us do have certifications. The majority of them, vast majority, I'd say 90%, are coming already referred to us from either Vocational Rehab Division or Developmental Disability Services Division. The other people that 10% that might be coming to us that haven't been referred have documentation that I'd be glad to share with you, or an audit that explicitly defines their disability. And it's obvious when you work with the individual that the person does
has a severe disability or barrier to employment. So I don't find ourselves in that predicament at all. But to me, there are so many people out there in need that, and the need is so great that to be bogged down with, gee, you know, did that person be certified by a doctor or a VR rep or whatever? It's obvious when a person gets into the program what their limitations are. We aren't serving people that don't have limitations.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Deborah Parker. Stephen, thank you here. Beck.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming you're sending a call on the Senate.
Yeah.
While we just go for the Senate, I guess.
My question is, will we have a chance to launch this boss if we come back with it?
Yeah.
Because several people referred to him, and I have a lot of questions.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Parker, and I'm here today. I am an employee of St. Vincent de Paul, and I'd like to just give a little personal background of myself. It would seem that I fall in this category that is less than severe. Diagnosis-wise, I have manic depression, post-traumatic stress disorder from 12 years of domestic violence from my husband. I also am a recovering heroin addict. And it's hard. It's been difficult for me. The other thing that I wanted to say is that I served session. I was the committee assistant for the House Transportation Committee. I served under Janet Atkins. When I began my position, I didn't have the diagnosis of the mental health issues, but I had 15 years in and out of heroin addiction. My background is such that I would have 2 or maybe 3 years clean and sober, and I would spin out of control, and eventually I would go back to heroin. I started my position for the legislature wonderfully. Everything was all right, but because of the stress and a few other things within my position description, I started to have failure. I started to have manic, and I didn't know at that time that I had manic depression. I thought I was just a really good employee. I would stay until 10 o'clock at night, and I would, you know, work on the computer, and I would have these brainstorms and all this motivation. What began to happen was I had flight of thoughts. I was forgetful. I didn't understand these things at that time. Eventually, in about March of the session, I resigned my position because I was taking time off work to go to physicians. I began to get rashes from stress, different things that aren't typically considered severe. I resigned my position so that someone could facilitate that position effectively. What it was to me was a failure. And without knowing that I had mental illness, I eventually went back to heroin approximately 3 months later. It was a blow to me to lose the position. I've worked for state government since I was 16 years old in Michigan. I've also worked for Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce in Michigan. I've also done public speaking and family preservation. I don't have a problem getting a job. I have a problem keeping a job. And now I understand a little bit about that. I'm not just a heroin addict. And that was how I deemed myself. That's how I would have guilt and shame, and eventually I would go back to heroin. I lost my children because of my inability to parent them properly. I took them to a relative here in Salem, and I left them there, and it was a spiral down to degradation, humiliation, until finally, in desperation, I went to the Harmony House, which is here in town, and I got rehabilitated and detoxified from heroin. Unfortunately, after 90 days of being clean and sober, I was still miserable, and I didn't understand that. I was not employable. Manic for me is loss of sleep, you know, some different things that I hadn't been diagnosed with previously. So I went to the physician in Portland, Pacific Gator Hospital, and was finally, at 38 years old, diagnosed with some of these mental health diagnoses that there are medications for. My father was 42 years old and was killed by a car in Eureka, California, because he had manic depression, and he ended up being vagrant after he had been employed for years and years at General Motors as an engineer. And my grandmother died in an asylum, kind of like Mr. Martin had spoke about earlier. This is a treatable disease, however, it's not considered severe. When I got the diagnosis, I went to the mental health provider, I was prescribed medication, and I started back to try to rebuild my life. I went to vocational rehabilitation, I got certified with a disability. I went to St. Vincent de Paul's, and they have been able to provide me with employment, and I'm still seeking an employment that can facilitate my disease. Recently, I had a medication change, and I was employed for the Department of Agriculture, and I ended up having to leave that position because of the medication. If that would have been a regular employment, I would have just lost that job. I called St. Vincent after a couple of days and was re-employed. They work me pretty regularly on part-time positions until I can find a position that is appropriate for my disease and my diagnosis. I have yet to regain custody of my children. I'm working to do that. I've been clean and sober for about 18 months now. And St. Vincent has allowed me the liaison between state government, to which I would like to get back into state government. I'm highly qualified. Some days I just have a hard time, and I need to find a position to do that. This law, if changed, would not allow me that. I would not be deemed severely disabled. But it's difficult for me, and I would ask that you consider that when you do the work session on Bill 684 and 708. Thank you.
I just want to introduce myself. My name is Roy Swords. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for St. Vincent de Paul Rehab. I want to give up my time, if possible, Senator. I realize we kind of moving. I'd like to have another one of our... All right, I'd like to, rather than me taking the time here, have the time one of our another one of our employees speak, if you don't mind.
Go ahead. If I could, I just wanted to say thank you for your testimony, and it takes a lot of courage to speak out about problems in one's life, and I know that you're here to do it, to try and help a program that you very much believe in. So thank you for doing that and sharing that information with us.
Thank you.
Oh, my name is Steve Baker, and about 10 years ago I had cancer.
I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
My name is Steve Baker.
Yeah, I mispronounced it.
Oh, I see. Well, anyway, about 10 years ago, I had cancer and lost my left lung and 5 ribs, and I'm about 80% down. And I couldn't do the job I was doing at the time as a production laser. And about 5 years later, in 95, Social Security reviewed my case and decided that I was no longer disabled and that I could find work and wasn't able to find any, so I went to Volk Rehab, and they told me to go over to Volk to St. Vincent de Paul, and they were to be able to help me with employment, you know. And
tell them where you work. What happened?
Okay.
Where do you work?
Well, I work for St. Vincent de Paul and Dr. Processing. And because of the way the law is now, I was be able to get that kind of work, you know. And that's about it. I'm not good at speeches.
Thank you.
Two comments. One, St. Vincent de Paul is one of these large We're not as large as Goodwill. They're at $36 million. We're about $21 million. We're trying to catch up with them. And I'm very proud of the fact that we're a large nonprofit. We have grown. We had 150 employees in 1992. Today we have 800 people working on various different jobs and all of our different business ventures. And I tell our, with the unemployment rate for people with disabilities 70%, I think it would almost be immoral for us not to try to grow and to try to employ more people like the ones that I have here at the table with me that I am extraordinarily proud of to have as employees. So, really that's the only thing I'm going to say. Thank you.
I certainly want to go on record saying I appreciate the work that these organizations do. Yeah, as I said, you know, when accusations are made and things come out, they need to be handled, they need to be gotten to. Maybe this isn't the best way of doing it. I don't know. I'm not a professional in that kind of thing to a certain extent. But I know you need to make some efforts. You need to do some things that that answer the accusations. You need to look into those things. You need to get them established. I would also say at this point in time that there are other efforts being made to employ the disabled, and I'm personally working to support the Department of Human Resources efforts to work within their department, and I believe it's about a $2 million request that would help us find jobs for more disabled folks, and I'm supporting that. I would guess that several others on my committee do too, and so we can get the governor off the track of giving everything to education this session. Why, we may have a few things left over at the Department of Human Resources and
one for both
more work.
Thank you, Senator Fisher, for the time you've
been. They're barred the doors, and I guess one of them put it
the police hard and barkeeper. The police hard the door.
For bartender board. But anyway, I appreciate folks coming. I apologize again. We didn't get everything handled that we would have liked to, but thank you for coming. And
thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your efforts, and good luck to you in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Close to the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services.